world, and the Buffalo kind of brought me out of my shell, you know, so to speak. And yeah, the music is, you know, it's taken me different places, and I feel that music makes things a little more palatable sometimes for, you know, because we could talk about killing buffalo and this and that, and I don't know, it's a very depressing subject, you know, so I feel like using the music in a good way could help make it a little bit easier to digest and hopefully motivate somebody, you know, to do something.
Yeah, brings in more people who are friends before they even knew that they were friends. And I myself have been very moved by the campaign. And we got to just tell people it's Wednesday at 7 at the Bison Coffee House. More information, call KBOO, go online, take a look there. This has been Air Cascadia for September 21st, Monday, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thank you, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Cassandra. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Iron Horse, born.
You can't roller skate in the buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in the buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in the buffalo herd. Be happy if you've mind to.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, hosted Wednesday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at Bison Coffee House in Portland. The event will feature stories and songs about the last wild buffalo and information about the ongoing struggle to protect them. That's the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, Wednesday, September 23rd, 7 p.m. at the Bison Coffee House, 3941 Northeast Cully Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Port Orford's Sustainable Seafood, Oregon's community-supported fishery, delivering monthly shares of line-caught seafood direct from the small fishing town of Port Orford to seafood-loving communities throughout Portland and the Willamette Valley. Details at posustainableseafood.com and at 541-671-0704.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 10 years ago, Hurricane Katrina nearly destroyed New Orleans. Now, 10 years later, parts of the city have not only recovered but thrive. Yet most African-American communities, whether they are low-income working-class neighborhoods like the Lower Ninth Ward or more prosperous communities like New Orleans East and Gentilly, still bear the devastating scars of Katrina. This morning, we talk with Gary Rivlin, author of Katrina After the Flood, about the politics and policy decisions behind the gaping disparities between the recovery efforts in Black and White New Orleans. Gary, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Well, last year I was at a conference just about this time in New Orleans, and the theme of the conference was resiliency, and that was the buzzword that you heard all around New Orleans, resilience. But I get the feeling that there's a great divide between what that word means in different parts of the city, and I wonder if you could talk about what is the dynamics that creates the difference of resilience and the meaning of resilience around New Orleans.
I mean, it's such an interesting place to start because, I mean, resiliency is such a beautiful concept, right? Like, we should all be strong enough to be to withstand whatever comes at us, right? Life is hard, and there's hurricanes, there's floods, there's fires, there's loss in our lives. We just need to be resilient, and that's what society should be paying attention to. So in the last 10 years, that's become a buzzword, but it's especially appropriate, or it's especially front of mind in New Orleans, where there's a big effort by the city to bring that along, but things are so divided there. It's just been such an uneven recovery that there's almost like a hostility these days to the word resiliency, because it's being used, arguably misused and abused to, we recovered in New Orleans because we're a resilient people. We're a strong people. We didn't wait for government. We just did. It's like, well, there's 100,000 less African-Americans living there, and I write about a few of them who work really, really hard. There are also policy biases that got in the way of many African-Americans coming back. There was a concerted effort to make sure that low-income and African-Americans didn't come back. There were regressive forces there. And you know, so this word resiliency just is like, well, like, what happens if you didn't come back? I guess you weren't resilient.
Well, also, there's a great image that I've brought back from each time I've been to New Orleans since Katrina of all the work that's going on in the Lower Ninth Ward. A lot of it, some of it is, I guess, a lot of hype, like Brad Pitt's Make It Right houses, but a lot of it is not that well observed outside. And yet it seems to me, and you point this out in your article that was in The Nation magazine at the end, where you're talking to Henry Irvin, who's a longtime resident, I guess the unofficial mayor of the Lower Ninth.
Thank you, guy, yeah.
And he says that the miracle is that there's even a Lower Ninth Ward today because they didn't want them to come back. And so the fact that the Lower Ninth still exists is perhaps the greatest miracle of resilience of all.
Yeah, I mean, New Orleans' story is so complicated to talk about. I mean, New Orleans since Katrina, because in some ways, it's miraculous. I mean, every individual, 110,000 homes were flooded, 20,000 businesses, 80% of the city was covered with water. That's unparalleled in modern U.S. history. There were forces in Washington saying we shouldn't rebuild. Dennis Hastert, the Speaker of the House at the time, said we should build those most of the place. And the fact that it's back, the fact that each individual, despite not getting enough insurance money or not enough help from the outside, rebuilt really is miraculous, and there's lots of little miracles like that. But you know, the shame of the Lower Ninth Ward is this self-fulfilling prophecy built on a mistake. The Lower Ninth Ward, even people in New Orleans, even the mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, 2 weeks after Katrina, said, we can't rebuild the Lower Ninth Ward. It's the lowest lying part of the city. It's not. It's lower because it used to be the Ninth Ward, and they built a man-made canal through the place in the 1920s and became an upper and a lower. This, you know, Lakeview, a prosperous white community, is lower lying. New Orleans East, which you mentioned earlier, better off black community, is lower lying. But there was this misperception. So it was the last place to open. 4 months after Katrina, they still had guards, National Guardsmen with rifles, not letting residents in. The last place to have electricity, the last place to get trailers, the last place to get gas. They didn't want to rebuild a school there. Before Katrina, there were five public schools in the Lower Ninth Ward. And one, an engineer said, was good enough to rebuild, but the parish district said, no, we don't want to rebuild there. They were going to demolish it. It was only the effort of a bunch of activists, an amazing story in itself, that saved the place, gutted it, and you know, it exists today. In fact, 2 years after Katrina, George Bush gave a speech there as a success story. So there's a million little stories like that of success, and yet the flip side is, this is only one-third of the population is back in the Lower Ninth Ward 10 years after Katrina because the government got in the way of the recovery.
Well, it's very startling to walk through the Lower Ninth Ward now. And actually, I had the opportunity to compare it with having been there a year and a half after the flood, where it kind of looked like the flood had just happened. It's 18 months later. There were still like lots and lots and lots of buildings that were collapsed. And the famous one that was I was on an Acorn tour, and they showed us, of course, the house that was on top of a car, and I think there were probably a number of structures like that. But what I saw when I was there last year was that there's some rebuilding, and yes, there's Brad Pitt's houses, and also Habitat for Humanity did a lot of building, and there's the musicians' houses, and lots of stuff going on. But there's an enormous amount of greenery in the Lower Nine, and it's not exactly like turning it back to a natural wetland. Is these kind of weedy greenery that grows up when land is not taken care of properly. So this is kind of these jungle thickets that dominate the landscape. And how do you feel at that, or in what way do you see that as kind of maybe a symbol of what's going on politically, socially, economically as well?
Right. So, I mean, the Lower Ninth Ward, it's the most pronounced. You know, this idea that you could just house after house after house is just missing. I mean, what you're describing today, it was just blocks and blocks of houses, and now it's just empty lots, overgrown weeds. Occasionally you see a Bastion home. Most of those have been ruined. So it's most pronounced in the Lower Ninth Ward, but it's in the Upper Ninth Ward. It's in the Seventh Ward. It's in other working-class communities in New Orleans. And in New Orleans, one thing that's interesting is, after Katrina, they said this was an equal opportunity storm. Lakeview, which I mentioned before, a well-off white community, was really badly flooded, 10 feet of water or more. Every single home there was damaged. But the truth is it wasn't an equal opportunity storm because of past racism, because of racial covenants, because of bias in lending, redlining and all. Blacks didn't have access to home ownership in big numbers until, you know, the 1970s. And by that time, the high ground had been taken. So in a city where 80% of the city was covered with water, it was the low-lying parts that were the worst hit. Well, with the exception of Lakeview, those were African-American communities, working-class African-American communities, middle-class, upper-middle-class. This, again, I mean, black home ownership was off limits while people were occupying the high ground, so they ended up in the low ground. So if you were a black homeowner, you were more than three times more likely to be flooded in New Orleans than if you were a white homeowner.
Well, another aspect is that also, what was the population, the demographics of black versus white before the storm?
So New Orleans was a city of 455,000 at the time of Katrina. Today, there are 100,000 less African Americans living in New Orleans than at the time of Katrina. You know, it's been profound. I mean, the whole city has lost people. There's 20% less people living in New Orleans today than before Katrina. There's a lot of newcomers. So even though I say, you know, 20% is missing, actually more are missing. It's probably more like 30% had never returned because there's been tens of thousands of newcomers. There's an energy in New Orleans, like in a Portland, like in a Brooklyn, like in an Oakland, California, with, you know, a lot of well-educated 20-somethings coming and creating restaurants and cool places and stores. And, you know, it's really thriving in some ways. But on the other hand, it just means a large portion of those who didn't live there, who lived there before, who called New Orleans home for their entire life, never returned.
Well, in your book, Katrina After the Flood, you describe the disparity between the rebuilding efforts in Lakeview, the white, well-off community, and in New Orleans East, which is probably on the income level very comparable to Lakeview, the big difference being that it's a largely black community versus a largely white community. So how did the two communities, what were their recovery efforts like, and how did they contrast?
Right, so it's really important to say that early on, it's the same story. You know, I mean, everyone's devastated. They're trying to figure out what to do. They're waiting on government, you know, to come up with some decision. But, of course, they're not just waiting on government. They're starting to meet. New Orleans East, the Lower Ninth Ward, doesn't make a difference. Lakeview, people started meeting early on. You start to see the change, or one difference, is that there's more wealth in the white community than in the black community. I mean, study after study after study shows that, you know, there's 20 times more wealth, you know, just savings and things you could dip into in the case of an emergency. There's much more wealth in the white community than the black community. But the great shame here is that there was this policy, Road Home, the largest housing recovery program in U.S. history. Over $10 billion was spent to help homeowners rebuild. Insurance is going to pay much of it, maybe, if you're lucky, but will make up the difference. So let's take a house in Lakeview, three-bedroom, two-bath, 2,000-square-foot home. It's worth $350,000. That's what it was bought for. Before Katrina, worth is important. And so you got $200,000 from your insurance company. We'll give you the remaining $150,000 to make you whole, up to $350,000. Now let's take the same home on the other side of the park, a black middle-class neighborhood, right on the other side of City Park from Lakeview. That home Same home, 2,000 square foot, three-bedroom, two-bath, that sold for $140,000 because historically, you know, homes in a black community are valued at less. Well, that person got $100,000 from insurance, so the government's going to make, road homes going to make them hold another $40,000 to bring it up to $140,000. Well, sheetrock costs the same on either side of the park. A contractor, a roofer costs the same. It costs more than $140,000 to rebuild that home. So someone in Lakeview who had $350,000, they had enough money, $100 a square foot, a little bit more. They had enough money to rebuild. You look at the same homeowner on the other side of the park, they didn't have enough money to build because this government program was built in a way that wasn't based on the cost of rebuilding. The whole idea was to help people rebuild. It was based on historic property value. This was brought to a federal judge 5 years after Katrina. That judge ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and said this was a racially discriminatory practice, but by then there was $140, $145 million left in this $10 billion program. In other words, it was way too late.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Gary Rifflin, who's author of Katrina After the Flood. And this is kind of a slightly delayed 10th anniversary program about Katrina. And your book was timed to come out just with the 10th anniversary of the flood. I wonder how you, looking back 10 years, what are your thoughts about overall the direction that the city's going in and the different visions that maybe we should actually go back to talking about what were the different visions that different power interests and powerless interests in the city had about how to reshape the city in the wake of the flood, and how has that come up to fruition 10 years later?
Right. So whenever there's a disaster, it's also an opportunity to let's rebuild right. Let's fix the things that were always wrong. The problem is there's a lot of disagreement on what that means to your vision question. And so, you know, kind of the white business interests, the powerful folks in New Orleans who go back generations, they had always run New Orleans. New Orleans, by the time of Katrina, was two-thirds black. So it was a black mayor, black city council and such. They saw Katrina as their opportunity to re-seize power, and they were pretty open about it. There was a famous quote 8 days, 9 days after Katrina in the Wall Street Journal by one of their well-known members, one of their leaders. You know, this is our chance to change New Orleans demographically, again, two-thirds black city, and change it politically, a black-run city. And so public housing, some public housing was flooded. Much of it wasn't, but it was fenced off and never reopened. It was knocked down. The big four. There are big four housing projects. None of them were reopened. They were knocked down. And in this place, mixed use. So there's much mixed income. So, you know, one way to make sure that there aren't as many low-income people, black people in the city, is we won't bring back public housing. Road home, racially biased program, thwarted, got in the way of people. The lack of wealth in the black community compared to the white. So at the five-year mark, 5 years after Katrina, those who were looking forward to a New Orleans that was demographically and politically different, in a way they won. It was a white mayor, white supermajority on the city council, white prosecutor where there had been a black prosecutor, white police chief, white-run schools, and white-run public housing. And so, you know, there really was this political takeover almost, using Katrina as the opportunity. The schools were taken over. For years prior to Katrina, the state had been trying to, or at least a year before Katrina, the state was trying to seize control of some of the city's schools. Katrina offered them their opportunity within 2 months.
Now, why were they trying to seize control of the schools?
Well, you know, so it was I mean, in fairness to those who were pushing for this, it was a lousy school system, and they didn't like the elected officials, the job they were doing. So the state saw this as their opportunity to come in, clean house, bring in, it's almost all charter system in New Orleans these days. 10 years later, the state's still running it. There's an elected school board. It's a majority black school board, but no schools have been returned, even those that are performing well. There's a fear that we can't return them to this board because the same thing is going to happen. Others argue, well, it's local rule. This is getting absurd here. And the same public hospital. The state had wanted to close down charity hospitals. New Orleans has had a public hospital since 1736. Never reopened after Katrina. Another way that it made it harder for those of modest means to come back when, you know, the city that always had a public hospital, it was shuttered and never reopened, even though FEMA and even though others said, the doctors who worked there included, said it wasn't in that bad shape, it could have been rebuilt.
Well, you also talk about the kind of a spiraling, downward spiral in neighborhoods like the Lower Ninth, and probably to some degree also in, I mean, even in an upper middle class neighborhood like New Orleans East, that if you, in the Lower Nine, they didn't rebuild the schools, and so the parents don't want to return because there's no schooling for their kids, and then the businesses don't return because there's no people to patronize the businesses. How was this? Was this something that was carefully strategized, or was this just kind of accidental the way it happened?
Right. So you know, the mayor at the time, Ray Nagin, did assemble a panel to come up with a plan. They came up with a plan. You know, there's some very good ideas in there, but it was a very controversial plan because they said some of the lowest-lying neighborhoods shouldn't be rebuilt. There should be a consolidation of the city. So the whole plan was thrown away, and even though there was a plan, it was never adopted, so there was essentially no plan, and it was just haphazard. A couple years after Katrina, you know, our recoveries are, you know, focused on a few strategic areas to see if, okay, let's see if we could make some changes to bring commerce here. Maybe we could give inducements to developers to start building housing here, and that will bring the stores and such. But you're exactly right. You know, it's everything dependent on everything else. When 80% of a city is covered by water, each individual is thinking, well, I have enough money to rebuild. Will anyone help me rebuild? What are my next door neighbors doing? Will I have a school for my kids? If you're older, you have someone in your family, you yourself have health problems, what kind of health care system is there? I mean, 2 years after Katrina, most of the hospitals were still closed. Many of the doctors weren't there. There wasn't the same infrastructure. And everything depended on everything else. In fact, you know, some of the reason that many black professionals didn't come back is, you know, they're a doctor, they're a lawyer, they need customers, they need patients, they need clients of their businesses. And for several years, there was so few people back that they ended up putting down roots somewhere else. And some, of course, are living a good life. It's not necessarily bad news for every person who didn't come back. Some people found a better school for their kids. Some people found a better health care system, whatever their needs were. There's some, you know, better job. My issue is the roadblocks that were put in the way of people. Most of the planning around New Orleans was to help homeowners. And it makes sense. You know, you had property and it was drowned and we want to help you rebuild. But 54% of the city were renters. There was no plan to help the renters. When FEMA, all those people, 50,000 or so, who were trapped in New Orleans after it flooded and FEMA sent somewhere, they gave you a one-way ticket. There was no return ticket to get you back to New Orleans. There was no plan to help those of modest means get back to New Orleans, again, because there are a lot of people who didn't want them to come back. So that's always my issue. It's like, for those who did want to come back, what kind of impediments were put in their way? What kind of policies were put in place that, whether intentional or not, favored, you know, the better off over those who really needed help?
Well, one of the big concerns, and you mentioned it a little earlier, was the idea that New Orleans was too sprawled out, was too hard to manage, that too many of the neighborhoods were lying too low, that there would always be in the path of danger with flooding and hurricanes. And in fact, when the first time I was in New Orleans back in 2000, I wondered, you know, why people lived in a city that was so much of it was below sea level. That this other part of it, I learned when I came back after Katrina that a lot of New Orleans isn't below sea level. So I wanted to both talk about the concern about the wisdom of rebuilding in flood zones, and not just in the floodplain, but the actual, I think they call it the floodway, you know, where it's a little different. I'm thinking of rivers now, but it's basically the same thing where the storm surges are just bound to happen and you're just definitely going to be a danger again. So was it wise to actually think about not rebuilding in other areas in certain neighborhoods? Could that have been done equitably? And then what's also this kind of weird thing about the perception of more of New Orleans being below sea level than it really is?
Right. So about half of New Orleans is below sea level, which is to say half is above sea level. And, you know, give the people who showed up there first credit. You know, if you see a map of New Orleans 100 years before Katrina, it's all the high ground. You know, we come up with our fancy technologies, the wood pump, it was called. It was a pump that could just pump out swampland and let people build below sea level. And that, of course, puts them in harm's way. We build levee systems. We build flood protection systems to protect people. There's a logic to New Orleans. I mean, it's the mouth of the Mississippi. It's a very important river. It touches 35-plus states and goes into Canada. There needs to be a city at the mouth of the Mississippi. Unfortunately, there wasn't really that much room put for one. And so we came up with levee systems. The levee that failed, I mean, half of a 350-mile levee system failed, it was rated to protect against a Category 3 storm. Katrina, by the time it hit New Orleans, was a Category 3 storm. This was a man-made disaster. It turns out the Corps, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the head confessed that it was a man-made disaster. One of the people who studied the disaster called it the worst engineering failure since Chernobyl. So the city supposedly had a strong enough system, and we wouldn't be talking about New Orleans right now, because we're talking about New Orleans because it flooded, not because of Hurricane Katrina. There was some wind damage, a little bit of water in the street. But once the levee system failed, that would cause the flooding. Now, $14.5 billion later, people are confident that New Orleans is much better protected than it was before Katrina. The big fear now are the coastal wetlands. We're not doing enough to stop the loss of the coastal wetlands. They're losing 25 to 30 square miles a year in coastal wetlands. And you could have the best levee system in the world, but if you keep on losing the wetlands, the natural buffer against storm surge, then New Orleans is again in danger.
Well, actually, I think New Orleans is not in that much more of a dangerous position than a lot of parts of Florida. And at the same conference that I was at last year, we saw some very chilling slides of scenes around the Miami area and the southern tip of Florida, where suddenly on a bright sunny day, the streets are full of water, and the water, it almost looks like Katrina-level waters in some of these neighborhoods. And then it disappears, and it all has to do with the way that that area has been cut and filled. So I wonder what some of the lessons from New Orleans are that could be applied to South Florida, and maybe people in South Florida should look a little bit more critically at where they're building and where they're living.
Well, the lesson from New Orleans around that is there was a civic conversation about not rebuilding neighborhoods, and there was great resistance. Like I said before, this mayoral panel suggested that in every neighborhood, you know, we have property rights. We're not going to go along with this, and in fact, they're right. It's a big deal, eminent domain, and usually has to be a very good reason. You can't, you know, it's very difficult for a government to eminent domain an entire neighborhood if there are people in that neighborhood fighting it. You need enough money. I mean, the whole idea, the whole logic of the plan that this mayoral panel came up with is that the government, the federal government, state government, city government, some combination thereof, would make people whole. You have to buy them out. And so, you know, just in a legal way, in a financial way, it's just so impractical. And I'd say in defense of a Miami or New Orleans, like, and there are forest fires in California, and people are losing their homes because people build there. Earthquake zone, you know, building along a river, you know, the Mississippi River floods in parts. There are rivers all over the country that flood. I'm in New York City, and, you know, they say post Hurricane Sandy that we're at greater risk than we realize. You know, there are those same kind of scenarios that show half of Manhattan underwater. And so I think we all, or much of the country, lives at risk. And getting back to where we started this conversation, it's like anticipating that risk, doing what we can to prevent bad things from happening. But if this is your turn, if this is just the once in 100 years, once in a 500-year disaster, that we're better prepared to take care of it. And of course, New Orleans after Katrina is a case study in not being prepared, from the botched rescue by the Bush administration to the preposterous FEMA system. Believe it or not, it's 10 years after Katrina. They're still negotiating. The city of New Orleans is still negotiating with with FEMA. It's just endless ridiculous systems that we've come up with. So, you know, people did learn some things from Katrina, had a better handle medical issues, hospitals being better prepared after Katrina. There were some disasters that are well known after that. But, you know, I still feel we have a lot more to learn. I'm not sure FEMA is that much better prepared for the afterwards than they were at the time of Katrina.
Well, that's something I think about a lot sitting here in the Cascadia subduction zone, where there's been a lot of prints lately about the great big earthquake that may be hitting here anywhere between now and 300 years from now. So it's true that we're all living with risk. However, I think that, as you're saying, the way of planning for risk is perhaps one of the ways that we can cope with potential disaster a lot better. And I wonder about your assessment of how the Reagan administration and the Blanco administration dealt with things in the moments and hours and weeks after Katrina hit, and how that shaped the kind of debacle that happened over the next few years.
Right. So actually, the governor at the time, Kathleen Blanco, a moderate Democrat, she took Katrina really seriously in the days leading up to it and was prepared. The problem was that the city wasn't prepared. Reagan did not take it seriously. In fact, the Saturday before, less than 48 hours before the storm hit, he was on the movie set playing a corrupt mayor in a child's movie. So he was not taking it seriously at all. Under Bush, you know, there were people in FEMA's office that were taking it seriously. It was the senior people who weren't taking it seriously enough. So in other words, the career folks in FEMA were taking it seriously. Mid-morning Monday, the city flooded starting 7:30 on a Monday morning. By 10:30, the FEMA's man on the ground was screaming to Washington, "We have a disaster in the making here. Send buses, send food, send helicopters, send any help you can." And it was the delay. And so there was a lack of trust of the eyes on the ground, that the folks in Washington didn't believe it. That would be, you know, one lesson here. And, you know, but to me, the issue is more, we have global warming. If you look at the statistics, there's so many more hurricanes and weather disasters than there have been. We need to be prepared. And these things are going to happen. What can you do to prepare in advance? New Orleans, before Katrina, had no evacuation plan to help those who didn't own a car. One in four people in New Orleans at the time of Katrina did not own a car. And the city had no plan. In fact, they had sent out a CD a month before Katrina saying, "We have no plan. You're on your own. Good luck." And yet, so when there was a mandatory evacuation order by Mayor Reagan, well, what good is that going to do someone that has no way of leaving? There were no buses or trains, help to get them on trains. Now there is. So New Orleans, which has experienced a disaster, they have an evacuation plan. But I wonder if, you know, folks in the Portland area, they have an evacuation plan, though there is talk of a bad, you know, disaster there.
Actually, so people are working on that. I mean, and that famous article that was in The New Yorker a couple months ago,
sure,
I think wasn't quite well informed with just how much people have been talking about this earthquake for years. So it's not like we're just started thinking about it and it could happen tomorrow. But it's I think also with earthquakes, there's a big difference between earthquakes and floods is you can evacuate from a flood because you have warning. With an earthquake, there's not a lot of time to evacuate.
Right. Actually, that's a good point. It's not the evacuation plan, which gets me to my second point. It's the problems in our system that don't seem to be fixed is that we have a ridiculously complicated way of helping communities. Weirdly, the Staten Island borough president, you know, a New York City official, and Staten Island was the part of New York City that was hit hardest by Sandy. He's reading my book and he's tweeting about it, and he's seeing these things that are just scaring him because it's 3 years after, or we're coming up on the 3-year anniversary of Superstorm Sandy, and of course, it's more of a 10-year time frame that New Orleans needed to recover. And as we start off the show, much of New Orleans hasn't recovered. I mean, there are black middle-class, black working-class neighborhoods in New Orleans that are 60-70% back 10 years after Katrina. So he's reading this thing, looking at there's a flow chart that the government gave. They hired a consultant to come up with a flow chart. Here is how you get the HUD money, the Housing and Urban Development money we've promised you. It measured 8 feet across. Someone in the recovery office in New Orleans told me it took them 6 months to get 2 feet. That system hasn't changed. What you need to do, the paperwork you need to file, all the agencies and groups that need to sign off and go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, it takes years and years and years. And, of course, this isn't an emergency. I mean, this is HUD operating after an emergency. Who knows? Who can imagine what it's like when it's just everyday situation? And that hasn't been fixed yet. You know, anyone who goes through any kind of catastrophe, whether it's hurricane, earthquake, what have you, is still going to have to hit that same system. That needs to be streamlined. That has to. It really hurts the development. When it took 2.5 years for federal money to show up in New Orleans, a lot of people had given up by that point. It made it harder to attract businesses when government's role should be to make it easier to help the individuals in a community rebuild and recover.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Gary Bivlin, who's author of Katrina After the Flood, and we're talking about what New Orleans is still going through 10 years after Katrina. One other thing we haven't touched on, and it sort of permeates your book, is all the corruption at the governmental level. And I was the first time I was in New Orleans, and I was trying to get a handle on this city, which I could not. It took me a long time to kind of understand and really appreciate the incredible culture of New Orleans, because there were these superficial things that were kind of getting me. And we're talking, a bunch of us, about the corruption. And this guy, a friend of ours, who is station manager of WWOZ, and he says, well, what do you expect about this corruption? This place is a swamp. But is that an excuse for the kind of level of corruption? I mean, when I was there last time, we went past City Hall and one of the perp walks was going by. And I might actually think Nagin was on trial when I was there. But, you know, it's just like this is kind of the way of things in New Orleans. And I wonder, is that really true, and how that has affected both before and after Katrina?
So, you know, in fairness to what I'm about to say, Ray Nagin is sitting in a jail cell right now in a federal penitentiary in Texas. One of his top aides is in a different federal penitentiary serving time for corruption while in office. The president of the city council at the time of Katrina did 3 years for public corruption, though it was for a bribe he took prior to Katrina. He wasn't sent away. He wasn't caught until after Katrina. So there's corruption in New Orleans. But I'll tell you, except for this one program that was supposed to help save historically significant homes in New Orleans, this wonderful architecture in New Orleans, except for this one program, corruption really wasn't the story. Ray Nagin went away for using his influence to help his sons get into a kitchen remodeling business in a city where 110,000 homes are flooded. There's a lot of remodeling opportunity. So he used his office to help his sons and himself, by extension, given he was an investor. But that didn't hurt the recovery, except for our mayor, or the mayor of New Orleans, was at the time distracted by something. But it's not public corruption. I mean, to me, the more bothersome stuff is the amount of money that was going to these big multinationals, the same companies you're hearing about after in Iraq, making Shaw, Bechtel, these big multinationals got all this business through Iraq. They had business through New Orleans after Katrina, no big contracts, and then you start to read the details. They didn't do any of the work. They just go subcontractor who subcontracts it to somebody else who subcontracts it to somebody else. There was a study that showed that to haul waste in New Orleans, the big multinationals were getting $48 a cubic yard for it. The person who actually did it was getting $4 a cubic yard. There was, they're multiplying prices by 6 or 8 or 10 times the actual cost of the work. And, that's the kind of corruption. That was the kind of waste of money. You know, if you got $1 billion and only, if every $1 billion, only $100-200 million is going to the people doing the actual work, that's a big problem. Yes, there was petty corruption. Yes, there was probably 100,000 taken here and 50,000 there. To me, the real corruption is all that money that was wasted on these big politically connected companies that feasted, that got rich. I mean, it's disaster capitalism at its worst. They did no work. They just got gazillions of dollars in profit.
Well, whose fault was that? Was that happening at the local level, or was that influenced by federal policy?
Yeah, that's just the system that FEMA has. I mean, it's largely federal. You know, they have contracts, ongoing contracts with all these, you know, usual suspect big companies where, you know, we're going to guarantee you this much money every year, and if there's a disaster, we'll give you this much more. And their logic is, well, we, the federal government, we, FEMA, can't go find contractors in the locales wherever a disaster might happen, so we're going to outsource that to the big multinationals. There's a logic to it, but I just don't know if they deserve six times the money that it actually costs to do the work. Yes, they can't be expected to have, you know, trucks and other equipment in every city in the country just in case. But on the other hand, it just seems too big a premium. But that is the system we have. That is the FEMA system. Like I said, to me, a lot of the problem is that the lessons we haven't learned are the after a disaster. They're going to happen. How can we better handle it? How can we streamline the system? How can we more efficiently use the money? It's precious federal dollars nowadays. It's, you know, it's such a fight over the size of the federal budget. Whenever there is money given, let's use it wisely. Let's not use $10 billion for a federal housing recovery program and then find out after the fact it was racially biased and actually hurt the black community over the white community. We need to be more careful. We need to be smarter about the way we use these precious resources.
Well, you have a couple sort of success stories in your book, and one I guess I would interpret as a partial success is a story of this black banker, like I guess the most successful black banker in the United States, Alden McDonald. Why don't we talk a little bit about his story and what it showed? I mean, how some things went right despite a lot of adversity.
Right. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, there's a lot of miraculous stories. I mean, the city that was given up for dead, I mean, I was in New Orleans for 8 months after Katrina. It felt like there's a possibility that this place would never really come back, that, you know, much of it would never be rebuilt. And, you know, you look at the story of this guy, Alden McDonald. I met him 11 days after Katrina. At the time, Liberty Bank, the bank he founded in the early 70s, was the sixth largest black-owned bank in the country. But they were devastated. Their headquarters, 80% of their customers lost their homes. You know, it's, you know, seven of their eight branches were destroyed. I didn't think they were going to make it. But, you know, he, smart guy who just kept on pushing and pushing and pushing. And now, 10 years later, they're the third largest, second or third largest black-owned financial institution in the country. You know, they now have branches in Detroit and Chicago and Kansas City and Houston around the country. He's a prosperous man. Liberty is a remarkably successful bank. But, you know, he's not a very happy guy because he was born in black New Orleans. He's from the eastern half of the city, which is to say the black half of the city, and it's not back yet. So he's doing well, but, you know, a third of his friends have never moved home. He looks at New Orleans East. He's, you know, his bank is headquartered in New Orleans East, this well-off black community in New Orleans. And 10 years after Katrina, it's maybe 80% back. A lot of business isn't back yet. A lot of the office space is just abandoned. It's never been rebuilt. There's still entire office buildings that are just moldering. They're sitting there 10 years later, and no one has done any work on it. So his is a positive story. He has a happy ending, but there's a real disappointment. There's a real sadness that this man has, that he's at the pinnacle of his career, and he was able to save his own home, his own family, his own bank, but not his community. I mean, his success is largely because they expanded outside of New Orleans. He doesn't do nearly as much business in New Orleans these days as he did before Katrina because there's just not as many customers there, potential customers there.
Well, Gary, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's been interesting talking with you, and maybe we'll check in on the 15th anniversary. I hope things are going better by then.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. We've been talking with Gary Rivlin, who's author of Katrina After the Flood. He's also a Nation Magazine Research Fellow and former writer for the New York Times. You've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll be rerunning a show I did last spring with David Biello, who's the Associate Editor for the Environment and Energy at Scientific American, about geoengineering. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go up with some music by Steve Earle. Thanks for listening.
city won't wash away. This city won't ever drown. Blood and water and hell to pay. Sky tear open, pain rain down. The medics come when they. I ever won't leave this town. This city won't wash away. This city won't ever drown. Ain't the river all the wind to blame. Cause everybody around here knows. Nothing holding back Poncho trains. A poor prayer and a promise is ghost. We just count digging our graves and silent marble above the ground. Maybe our bones will wash away. But this city won't ever drown. Die just as long as a heart be strong, like a second line stepping high. Reason hill is rolling along. Chantilly to the Woo-Kray, low and nice, such a city of town. Singing Giacomo Pinani, this city won't ever drown.
And it is just a few seconds before 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and coming up next is Health Watch. Today, host Dr. David Naiman speaks with Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein about gaining ground. Their feature-length documentary film telling the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practices. And at 11:30, you will want to stay tuned to hear a new report on the nation's prison population as host Doug McVeigh interviews Mark Mayer of the Sentencing Project and Jason Zeidenberg of the Justice Policy Institute. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for your community radio station. If you are not yet a member, you know, you can still become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a feature-length documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein on Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st at Cinema 21 in Portland. Gaining Ground tells the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practice so they can feed their local community.